devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the morning show today. I'm Gregory Berg. Originally today we were going to preview a documentary that was originally scheduled to air tonight on PBS's American Experience about inventor Thomas Alva Edison. That's been postponed because of tonight's State of the Union address by President Obama. So that documentary is airing next Tuesday, and presumably we'll have a preview for you airing next Tuesday as well. But in its place, a fascinating interview about two fascinating and important Americans, Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee, coming up on today's morning show.
To graduate.
When it comes to
point to graduate with no demerit.
When it comes to significant figures in American history, it's hard to think of two men who played a more crucial role in the direction of American history than Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee, who, of course, were the ultimate commanders of their respective armies in the war between the states. And much has been written about both of these men, and a fair amount of myth and misinformation has sprung up about both of these men, which makes the task of historians even trickier in terms of trying to get at the heart of exactly who these men were and what they represented then and now. And a brand new book has been written, meticulously researched and beautifully written, called Crucible of Command, Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee, The War They Fought, The Peace They Forged. The author of the book is William C. Davis, and there are more than 50 books to his credit, focusing particularly on the Civil War and the history of the South. And he was also a important consultant for the A&E Network's long-term documentary series called A Civil War Journal. And this newest book is published by Da Capo Press, again called Crucible of Command. William Davis, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. I'm delighted to be with you.
You have tackled a very significant challenge here in wanting to craft vibrant portraits of both of these men. And you tell us very early on that you did not conceive of this book as a standard biography of each of them. This is not so much a dual biography as something else. Explain what your intention was with this book.
Well, there have been several excellent biographies of both, and as you're quite right, my goal was not to do a sort of soup-to-nuts complete life of each of them. These portraits are more designed, I think, as appreciations and investigations into what made them the men they were, and especially what made them the commanders they were once the Civil War commenced. So I'm much more interested in the origin and development of their personalities, their characters, what shaped their moral and ethical compasses, what are the kinds of things that in all of us help to inform the way we make decisions, and therefore to see the influences that ultimately informed the decisions that these men would make when called on to make some of the greatest decisions in American history. So someone looking for A, B, C, D, E, and F on their lives would get a lot out of the book, but if they're not complete lives at all. They're rather, I think, intimate portraits.
As I touched on in the introduction, for Grant and Lee both, there is a fair amount of myth that surrounds each of them. At one point in the introduction to the book, you said the myths long ago replaced the men. And you go on to kind of spell out some of those myths or some of those ways in which we tend to think of these two men. And depending on if you're from the North or if you're from the South, that can dramatically shape maybe the myth to which you sort of latch on to. First of all, just remind us of the kind of myths that tend to surround both of these men, Grant and Lee.
Okay, yeah, sure. And first of all, I'll actually observe, you made the comment, which is a good one, about point of view. Myth is all about point of view, whether you're from the North or the South. But in the case of these men, that's not always the case. Robert E. Lee has become kind of a universal hero, not just in the United States, but indeed around much of the world. I find it interesting that, you know, here's a man who led armies fighting against the United States government, but he's appeared on our postage stamps. He may have lost in the war, but he's kind of conquered in the peace. And the myths about Lee are legion, that he grew up in near poverty, which, of course, is not the case. His mother was among the top 10% in annual income in America at that time. There's the myth that Lee always never referred to the Union Army or the Federals as the enemy, that he could never bring himself to think of people from the North as enemies. That's just not the case. He repeatedly refers to them as the enemy, and sometimes as worse. Indeed, by about the midpoint of the war, Lee had genuinely come to hate Yankees, and I think almost regarded them as a separate and inferior race to white Southerners. He was filled with hatred for them by the end of the war because of personal loss that he'd suffered and that he'd seen the South suffer. Myths about Grant, of course, the one that most people know is that Grant was a drunkard, which is not at all the case. He did not handle alcohol very well, but he wasn't an alcoholic. There were only four or five documented instances during the entire course of the war in which Grant had too much to drink, and he was well aware of it, so that he actually had one of his staff officers sort of appointed to remind him not to have too much to drink. But he didn't go. He could have one drink and stop. He didn't go on week-long benders. He just was a man who didn't assimilate alcohol very well. In fact, most of the time, he's a very sober fellow. Another myth about Grant, of course, is that he only won victories because of overwhelming numbers and resources. And again, that's not the case. In several of his battles, he, in fact, is facing almost equal numbers. And since Grant was almost always the aggressor, his opponents had the actual advantage of being on the defensive while Grant came to them. Those are just some of the myths. One of the interesting things about the mythology of these men is that anybody who sets out to try to cut through it where both are concerned is going to get in trouble, because virtually all of the Lee myths are very positive. They reinforce and amplify what was already a sterling character. All of the myths about Grant are almost uniformly negative. So if you set about to undercut both of them, you're going to sound like you're putting down Lee and aggrandizing Grant. So you're going to, I've already seen one review that says this is a pro-Grant and anti-Lee book, which is not the case. That's just the kind of artifact you have of going after the two men in the course of one book.
Right. And particularly in the case of Lee, where there is such nobility that surrounds him, and rightfully so, that any author then who comes along and seeks to give us in a sense, more complete, fully human portrait of Lee, flaws and all, is destined to be attacked for that from quarters.
Lee is virtually venerated, and to a large degree deserves to be. He's a man of sterling character, enormous self-sacrifice. He's a man who faced some very difficult choices in his personal life, in his personal allegiances. There have been a few very negative Lee biographies, and I think it's very difficult to do one unless you just ignore the overwhelming wealth of material there is out there to support the idea that, in fact, he's a very, very fine man indeed. And the more I looked at Lee, the inner man, the more I came to kind of feel sorry for him. He was not a happy man in his personal life, and he faced a lot of loss and a lot of hardship, and still managed to keep going, which is another sign of pretty strong character.
Hmm. One more question or point about this matter of myth. I think this is particularly interesting, and then this is also from the introduction of the book. The introduction is subtitled Icons. You write, to earlier generations, they were the greatest heroes of their time, deservedly the most popular, and if they wished it, influential men in their sections. The country needed both of them after the war and into the century beyond. And I thought this was so striking that, for instance, the myth that sprang up around Lee, that was important both to the North and to the South. I mean, we immediately understand why the South would want to venerate General Lee, even in the wake, and maybe especially in the wake of their defeat. But you go on to explain why the North was also well served by the myth of General Lee as this exceptionally noble figure. Explain why.
Well, there are a number of reasons. First of all, at the most basic level, there's very little glory in defeating a craven or cowardly or inept foe. The greater the General Lee is, the greater the victory over him becomes. And so there's that element that going on in the North immediately after the war. But it's very quickly, I think, superseded by this sort of rush to reunification. Both sides are exhausted. The North just wants to put the war behind it and kind of forget it. And one way to help have a relatively easy reunification and reconstruction is by glorifying, indeed almost deifying, Robert E. Lee as an icon of the Confederacy that even Northerners can respect, because he is so manly, he's such a gentleman, he had a high public opinion prior to the war. He's someone they can admire and therefore welcome back in open arms. The North saves all of its vilification, really, for Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy, and in some cases some other generals. But in 1865, Lee had become, not only in the North but also in the South, really the personification of the cause. Mm. Even Southerners really looked to Lee more than to Davis as their leader and their model. The interesting thing is that 40 years later, as the old veterans write memoirs and whatnot, even soldiers who never set foot in Virginia will retroactively change their recollections so that they can remember when they fought with Lee.
Mm. This is what you write in your introduction. There was no glory in besting a frothing rebel. Jefferson Davis would be vilified for years after the conflict as a tyrant and traitor responsible for the deaths of thousands of prisoners of war. He offered no texture, no nuance to a North anxious in after years to have beaten the right sort of foe and in the right way. Lee provided all of that, however. Defeating a knightly foe lent dignity to victory. From his supposedly anguished and heavily romanticized choice of loyalties in May 1861, through his series of near-miraculous victories, and on into his dignified and mostly restrained conduct after the war, he offered everything anyone could want in an enemy beaten.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Lee's conduct after the war, from the Northern point of view, is for the most part exemplary. Lee was broke at the end of the war. He owned no property. He had very little money saved, and of course most of that would have been in Confederate money at that point. He faced an extremely uncertain personal future. He's almost immediately swamped with offers from insurance companies and railroads and other corporations to accept high-paying positions as figurehead president. The business of celebrity product endorsement did not begin with Michael Jordan and tennis shoes. It goes back to the Civil War. Every new company, insurance, railroad especially, had to have a Civil War general as its figurehead president. But Lee turned all those down, though they could have made him a wealthy man, and instead accepted the presidency of dying Washington College, which was barely able to keep its doors open. And, of course, in the remaining span of just 5 years of his life, he turns it around, sets it on the road to growth, builds faculty, builds curriculum, and uses himself as an example of what he constantly and consistently preaches to to all former Confederates who seek his opinion, which is to stop grumbling, stop complaining. We don't like the way the war ended, but there's nothing we can do about it. Accept the fact, and then go to work in your homes and your communities to rebuild your own lives and rebuild your communities and rebuild the South so that it can once again, you know, play a significant role in the affairs of the nation.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with William C. Davis, who is the author of a very fine new book called Crucible of Command, Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee, The War They Fought, The Peace They Forged. I wonder if we could just pause for a moment before we delve into some specifics about these two men and just talk a moment about some of the choices you made as the author of this book in terms of the kind of resources to which you turned to paint this richly detailed portrait of these two men, albeit
sure.
Not full-length biographies of both men, as we've already talked about. I think it's in the preface that you mention some specific and probably some people would find surprising choices that you made in terms of the kind of sources that were most important to you and others to which you maybe scarcely glanced.
Right.
Tell us about those choices.
From the outset, I decided to use, if possible, almost exclusively primary sources. That is, documents written at the time by Lee and Grant, or documents written at the time about them by people with whom they were well acquainted, therefore people who were in a position to know what they were talking about. So I haven't looked at biographies. I didn't, for the most part, use memoirs by anybody unless there was simply no other source. That's not to say those are bad works at all, but the problem is that memoirs and autobiographies have an inherent problem, which is that all of us, the older we get, have a tendency to recast our recollections of our earlier years in ways that are most flattering to us. As a result, I didn't even use Grant's memoirs very much at all. It is generally acknowledged to be one of the best, if not the premier autobiography ever written by an American. It's just wonderful reading. But even Grant was not immune to the temptation occasionally to explain away or to rationalize some of his mistakes. And, of course, biographers are inherently liable to falling in love with their subjects and being too easy on them when they shouldn't be. I hope to avoid adopting anybody else's bias or viewpoints by not using biographies, and hope at the same time to stay closer to the facts by not using memoirs and autobiographies. Even diaries can be dangerous sometimes, because anybody who writes a diary does it in at least the some knowledge in the back of their head that someday someone else may read it. So diarists will always present themselves in the best possible light.
Hmm.
This may be it's not a unique approach to me at all, but there are those who certainly would criticize it, because at the same time that I don't risk adopting biases or viewpoints other than the conclusions I come to myself, it also means that I was not exposed to what might have been some very useful conclusions by other historians since. So there's an inherent compromise there, but I prefer to go to the original sources if at all possible. And with both of these men, those sources are so abundant that I could find there what I really needed to get viewpoints inside the men's heads.
Are they equally abundant? That is, the first person sources or primary sources about both of these men, are they equally abundant, or did you find them much more plentiful for one versus the other?
They're certainly more plentiful for Grant. For one thing, of course, he was president. So as a president, he generated tens of thousands of documents. And fortunately, just as I was beginning the work on this book, the, I believe, 32nd volume and final volume of the Papers of Ulysses S. Grant was published, encompassing virtually every known document that he ever wrote. It wasn't one-stop shopping by any means. There was still a lot of work to be done in other sources. But it made the job much, much easier than it might have been. There's nothing similar for Lee, but there are large, major collections of his papers scattered around the country, and particularly here in Virginia. So it was not as hard a task as it might have been. And Lee wrote thousands of letters, many of which survive. I think overall he generated a little less correspondence than Grant.
And never wrote a memoir like Grant.
No, never wrote a memoir. So it's uneven in a way. For instance, for Grant, up until he's out of West Point and in the Army, only a handful of letters survive. Lee wrote a lot of letters when he was a young man, chiefly to his future wife during their courtship. So there are some segments of each man's life which it's easier to get at than it is for the other.
And I was intrigued, for instance, by the relatively little information we have about Robert E. Lee's childhood. You write at one point, childhood is the forgotten chapter of biography. Robert Lee casts barely a shadow in his own story until early manhood. And how frustrating that must be for someone like you, wanting to understand who Robert E. Lee was and what shaped him into who he was, if we have relatively little to go on in terms of his own childhood, especially compared to Grant.
That's right. And that's one of the areas, by the way, in which Lee's subsequent biographers have been especially imaginative. Some have taken about half a dozen documents and managed to spin out a whole chapter based on them, which calls for an awful lot of assumption and rationalization. The earliest letter written by Lee doesn't come until he's on his way to West Point, and it's a very brief statement. All we really have other than that are a few mentions of him in letters or in recollections by members of the family and friends some years later. So it took a lot of research and other sources to at least build the context in which Lee was living and growing up as a young man, what the schools were like that he went to, the fact that the family really was not living in penury, but were really pretty well off. We really don't get Lee speaking for himself until after he leaves West Point, and then starts to be the beginnings of a correspondence that he's pretty active at for the rest of his life.
Hmm. You mentioned right off the bat that Grant and Lee met in person only four times in their lives. Sketch those four times for us, because just in knowing that, we have some sense of the lives that they lived being, in a sense, parallel lives that only once in a while literally intersected.
Yeah, well, there's only four we know of, and that's probably all there were. Their first meeting, see, they're 15 years apart in age, so they were not at West Point at the same time. They never had any postings in the peacetime army in the same place. The first time they encountered each other was with General Winfield Scott's army marching from Veracruz to Mexico City in 1847-48. And it's known that they met. We don't know if they met more than once or not. Grant always remembered it because Lee was such a memorable figure. Even then, he was kind of the ideal soldier in the eyes of many. Lee, in later years, was aware that he'd probably met Grant but couldn't remember it. That's the impression Grant made on Lee. So no sort of friendship commenced, so far as we know. Their second meeting was April 9, 1865, in the surrender ceremony at Appomattox, when Lee is overburdened with combinations of grief and responsibility, but also relief. And Grant, in fact, has an overburdening sense of empathy and consideration for the feelings of this defeated foe, to the point, in fact, that he had a severe headache prior to their meeting. The next meeting was the next day, April 10th, and it's the one we know almost the least about. The two met for about half an hour in the middle of a field, each sitting on his horse. Neither left any sort of full account of what they discussed. But we do know from some comments by Grant that it was something to the effect of his trying to persuade Lee to go beyond just surrendering the Army of Northern Virginia, because Lee was now General-in-Chief of the Confederate armies, and the Confederate government was in flight. Lee could have, on his own authority, called for all remaining Confederate soldiers to surrender turn in their weapons and give their paroles, and that would have ended the war at a stroke, saving perhaps thousands more lives and who knows how many millions in treasure. Lee did not feel he could do that without consulting the President, Davis, first. And, of course, nothing came of that. And then finally, when Grant became president, one of the first things he did when he moved into the White House was, via a back channel, diplomatically get into Lee's hands an invitation to call on him at the White House. And Lee, in fact, did come visit Grant at the White House in April of 1869, just weeks after Grant took office. They had, again, about 45 minutes of private discussion. Again, no one else was present, so all we know is what Grant later said, which was apparently that he was trying to persuade Lee to take a more public and active role in the public arena, to recommend not just to Virginians but to Southerners abroad to go along with the 15th Amendment to the Constitution and to show less resistance to being reunified into the Union in order to avoid what eventually happened, of course, which was military reconstruction. And again, Lee apparently politely declined to enter the public fray. He did not like newspapers. He hated to see his name in newspapers. And I think he felt he was doing as much as he could or ought to do simply by advising everyone to get back to work and rebuild.
We're speaking with William C. Davis about his book, Crucible of Command, Ulysses S. Grant and Robert E. Lee, The War They Fought, The Peace They Forged. In this portion of the book where you talk about the early lives of both Grant and Lee, it doesn't take as long. In fact, it's page 8 of the book, and you are already talking about something that you've already mentioned, the sort of sense of melancholy that often was a part of Robert E. Lee's personality. You write at one point, Lee spent his teen years repressing feelings, a habit that proved hard to break in manhood. He kept doubts, hurts, and disappointments to himself and resolved that he could show joy but not grief. He could not open himself. "I am not very accessible," he confessed later. Those last few words I find remarkable, in that I think most of us tend to think of past eras, and particularly men, as always being inaccessible in terms of their deep feelings, and in a sense it's really pretty remarkable that Robert E. Lee would consider that remarkable about himself. I mean, worth even mentioning. Can you say a little bit more about that and some of the ways in which that played out and might have been a significant factor in how Lee, for instance, conducted his duties as a general?
Lee was, he had enormous, really abnormal responsibility thrust on him at an early age. His father left the country to escape debt and essentially abandoned the family when Lee was just about 8 years old, and his father actually dies when Lee is about 11. His father's pretty much a stranger to him. Lee was the oldest boy still at home with his mother and his other siblings, so it fell to him to be the man of the house that when he's barely a teenager, especially responsible for taking care of an ailing and increasingly infirm and, I think, often very difficult mother. And with sisters to tease him and all the usual sort of thing like that. Apparently from an early age, he just learned to be stoic and to do what was his duty and to hide whatever inner feelings he had. Those comments, by the way, that you just read don't come from me. They're based on what Lee would say to his wife in letters when he was courting her. So that's one occasion, and only really with her for the most part, that he's really open about what he's actually thinking and feeling. It cut him off a lot. That and his sense of rigid application to study and duty, it cut him off from a lot of just the fun that young men otherwise would have. In later years, he admitted that he had few friends, and he regretted that he had not taken the time to make more friends. The result was that it made Lee seem to others as aloof, sometimes having feelings of superiority, which was not the case. It's just the manner he developed that helped him to survive in the context in which he grew up. it may not really have hurt him when the war came. He formed some good associations with some of his more promising subordinate officers. He wasn't intimate with many, but they certainly at least respected him, even if they didn't necessarily know him very well. Even one of his closest personal associates, Walter Taylor, who was his adjutant during the war, a man who virtually lived in Lee's tent with him for years, would admit more than once that the tycoon, as he called Lee, was an enigma, that he didn't really understand him very well. I don't think that necessarily hurt Lee's generalship, except that he was so much in the habit of consulting only his own counsel that he really didn't engage a lot in so-called councils of war, soliciting the opinions of others. But then Grant was much the same way. Feeling that he's ultimately responsible for what happens, he often felt it was best to make his decisions in a vacuum, after perhaps hearing other views, but making the decisions entirely himself. Lee carried it's not depression, it's perhaps not even sadness, but that degree of reserve with him really right up until he died. He was never able to overcome it. Though there was a playful side of him that tried to escape it from time to time, he had a pretty good sense of humor. Unfortunately, his wife, the older she got, approved less and less of Lee showing any humor. So if he tried to laugh or lighten up, she would discourage him.
Hmm. One other thing about their early lives that I find really, really interesting is at one point you kind of contrast their childhood, saying that Grant's childhood was probably happier than Lee, although they both had certain frustrations, and you say both had very much significant frustrations with their fathers, albeit for different reasons. Yeah. And you kind of go on to spell out some of that, which is quite interesting. And then you write this: the differences between them were largely cosmetic, growing far more from accident of birth than individual character and ability. I thought that was so interesting, because I think you're pointing to maybe what you were talking about with certain biographers who might make the mistake of leaping to conclusions and maybe drawing conclusions about maybe the inherent character of somebody based on what they did or kind of how their lives unfolded, when in fact sometimes the reason things unfold and we do the things we do don't really have so much to do with those profound questions of character, and sometimes are just from pure accident. That's a really intriguing point, I think.
Yeah, accident and experience. Lee, as you said, Lee and Grant have very different childhoods, but they both, in a way, tended to mold them in the same direction. I mentioned a moment ago all this abnormal responsibility that Lee had thrust on him at an early age. But he adapted to it. He did what he felt he had to do. And what it did was, I think, help to forge in him a personality that was so constituted as to accept responsibility as a matter of course, which is very important when the war comes and he has to take great decisions for which he's got to be willing to accept responsibility. Grant's childhood was entirely different. His father was a jackass, but at least he was always present. Grant grew up in the most well-to-do home in his community out in Ohio. His father was pretty well off. But the father gave Grant enormous freedom. Unlike Lee, who was chained to his mother as a young man and really never went more than about 50 or 60 miles from Alexandria in his life until he went to West Point, Grant, thanks to his father, was given virtual free rein to roam the countryside. His father would have Grant, when only a teenager, take a wagon load of goods on a business trip 100 miles away or 200 miles away. Grant, by himself, as a teenager, traveled all the way from southern Ohio to Pittsburgh, to Wheeling, to St. Louis, to Chicago, things that even today most parents would not allow a 12 or 13 or 14-year-old child to do. I figured by the time he went to West Point, Grant had by himself probably traveled 1,500 to 1,700 miles. And as I say, Lee probably only traveled 50 or 60 miles. But what it built in Grant, again, was this sense of responsibility as just something that was natural. When an 8-year-old can take a wagon load of goods someplace and manage a team of horses, it builds a self-confidence. And so when it comes to making decisions in the war, both men are perfectly at ease, taking enormous risks and making enormous decisions because they have no problem whatever with responsibility, which can't be said for a great many of the other army commanders of that war on both sides.
You talk about how actually at West Point, and they were not there at the same time, but we wouldn't necessarily look at either of these young men and how they did at West Point and ever imagine the greatness that was in their respective futures.
Yeah, there's Lee certainly turned in a vastly better performance than Grant, of course. Lee graduates not at the top of his class, but number two in his class, which is often forgotten. There's a man named Charles Mason who just was always a few points ahead of him. But Lee graduated with no demerits. Now, it's sometimes missed. One of the myths about Lee is that he was the only cadet at West Point to graduate with no demerits until Douglas MacArthur. That's not true. It happened all the time. In his own class, there were something like 20 other students with no demerits. In those days, it was harder to get a demerit, and it was easier to get rid of it. Grant, on the other hand, graduated with a nice full complement of demerits and finished in the bottom half of his class. He had a good time. He didn't apply himself that much to his studies. He preferred reading comic novels to reading textbooks. But he still showed some abilities, particularly in horsemanship. But anyone looking at Grant was not going to expect that he was going to wind up becoming a premier soldier by any means. It was going to take experience and opportunity for him, as for Lee, to put them on the road to high command.
You mention around the time that Robert E. Lee gets married that he proffers to his new wife an apology for being what we would call now a control freak. You write, Lee wanted and needed control in all aspects of his life. He understood that, even if he could not always keep it in check, and it sometimes led to conflict. I think you've touched on this already, that in some ways maybe because Lee did not tend to look outward, cast his net very wide for input and counsel from others, that might in part be driven by this tendency for him to want to maintain as much control as possible.
I think so. Feeling, again, so much responsibility at an early age. Lee adapted to that by kind of the attitude of, if you want something done right, you must do it yourself. And he didn't have very good experience with trying to delegate when he was a young officer down in Savannah, Georgia, building Fort Pulaski. He found that workers would not do what they were told, that subordinates often wouldn't do what they were told. And it took him a long time to sort of figure out how to get people to do what he wanted. As a result, by the time of the Civil War, Lee is not very good at delegating. Those around him, his close associates, will complain that he does too much himself rather than delegate tasks to others. And I think it's because he feels responsible for everything, and the best way to make sure everything is well done is to have a hand on it yourself. Grant grows up with a very opposite viewpoint in that regard. He, from the very outset, seems to have understood the benefits of delegation so long as you could find good, trustworthy subordinates. So once Grant set something in motion, he was content to let someone else handle it unless there was a problem, and then Grant would step in. So in a way, that made things a bit easier for Grant come the war than they were for Lee. His biggest failure in the control department, of course, was his own wife, Mary Custis, who was willful and spoiled. And I think, you know, it's always dangerous today to try to put somebody from 150 years ago on the couch and psychoanalyze them, because they can't answer back. But certainly there are aspects of her behavior, as he describes it, that suggest she might have had something similar to bipolar condition today. Erratic behavior, behavior that was designed to call attention to herself in bizarre ways. She woke up one morning and didn't like the way her hair looked, so she shaved it all off. And so Lee was constantly apologizing for his wife, and especially having trouble getting her to control spending and that sort of thing. So that I think he regarded her as his, sort of his greatest failure in the matter of control.
We should leap ahead to the Civil War itself, and we don't have very much time left, but I do want to touch on just a couple of matters. I want to make sure our listeners understand that this is an incredibly thorough, meticulously researched book, and that we are just touching on a few intriguing high points in what is a thoroughly fascinating book. One of the things that's quite intriguing as the Union actually splits into two nations and the Civil War is about to begin, you paint a really intriguing picture of these two men and how they viewed the situation and the war, which almost certainly was about to begin. Ulysses S. Grant, for one, by at this point in time, not yet any kind of really significant figure, you say had kind of a sense that the war that was about to be fought would probably last maybe a little over 90 days. He imagined it would be a war quickly and relatively easily won. And Grant, of course, changes his mind about that in fairly short order. Just tell us, though, what would lead him to think such a thing.
One of the reasons there was a war, I think, is that both North and South seriously misjudged the feelings and the determination of the other side. So both sides expected a short war. Grant believed that this secession crisis and the war that was coming had been brought on by Southern radicals, which indeed it certainly was, but also in some part by Northern radicals, the new Republican Party, which he did not yet entirely support because he thought they were making it, the abolitionists especially, the abolitionist wing of the Republican Party, were too insulting, you know, too hard, too anxious to bring down slavery by a violent means if necessary, thus virtually forcing the South towards secession. But he didn't think the Southerners would stand very long. And Grant's actually kind of slow to come to the realization of how long the war is going to be when he actually has his first command in late 1861. He believes that, well, one more victory, and that'll be the end of the rebellion. And then after he wins the Battle of Shiloh, he says, one more victory, and that should end the rebellion. And he kind of keeps saying one more victory for about another year. It's really not until sometime in 1863 that he realizes, well, this is going to go on longer. But, of course, Grant's war up to 1863 and the taking of Vicksburg has been nothing but a string of victories. Grant has been winning the war in the West. But he not until 1863, I think, does he begin to appreciate that what is sustaining the Confederacy is largely the war in Virginia, and that's the war being conducted by Robert E. Lee.
Mm. Robert E. Lee, as this war is about to begin, fervently hopes and prays that no such war will be fought. He writes, no earthly act would give me so much pleasure as to restore peace to my country. This is at a point in time, you tell us, when it was hard for him to refer to the Northerners, to the Yankees, as the enemy, although that would change as the war progressed.
Right.
But you tell us, he was still, that is Robert E. Lee, no friend of secession, nor did he as yet show any emotional stake in the Confederation. I think it's so interesting to think about somebody like Robert E. Lee, who in fairly short order would assume, in a sense, supreme command of the Confederate forces, as this war is beginning, has such misgivings about the whole notion of seceding from the Union or about this war at all being fought. I mean, it's really hard to kind of wrap our heads around what that would feel like for someone like Robert E. Lee in his position.
That's one area in which he and Grant think identically, really. Lee believes that this conflict has been brought on by Southern extremists out for their own gains, but also by the Republicans in the North and their this constant pressure against slavery. Lee and Grant both kind of come out of the same political milieu. Neither was active politically, but they were both essentially Whigs, which in that period of time would essentially be those who were slightly left of center, comparable to today's Democrats. They both believed in strong central governments. They believed in the Constitution. And then Lee thought all these extremists were just risking tearing all that down over issues that could be settled amicably if men would just sit down and talk. And interestingly enough, even after the war has commenced, even in May 1861, after Lee has resigned his commission in the United States Army, after he's become a major general commanding Virginia state forces and is about to become a general in the Confederate Army, he will still occasionally refer to our poor country, meaning the country as a whole, and still maintain some hope that somehow an accommodation can be made, that some compromise can be found that would allow the two sections to reunify peacefully in return for some kind of constitutional guarantees of Southern rights to take their slave property into the territories. He really doesn't irrevocably, and this is typical of a lot of Whigs in the South who became Confederates. I think he really doesn't think reunion is impossible until about the end of 1861 and early 1862.
You tell us that for both of these men, although what I'm looking at the moment in your book is focusing more on Lee, but you give credit to both Grant and Lee for this particular characteristic. You're saying, as with Grant, Lee's surpassing skill lay in his reaction to setbacks and the unexpected. And you go on to say, in this particular case of Lee turning a particular setback into a bold, decisive response, which really turned the corner for the Confederates, at least for that short little amount of time. But I think that's a very important thing for us to talk about, because it is probably among the rarest of characteristics, and also something that tends to be misunderstood and maybe very underappreciated by those of us looking from the outside in.
Sure. One of the great commentators on military thinking was Karl von Clausewitz, who in one of his books talks about an army as a machine. And he'll say the commander makes all the preparations, gets everything exactly as it should be. The machine is well-oiled. It's in perfect working condition. But then the moment he puts the machine in motion, it begins to break down. And that happens in virtually every military operation throughout history. As soon as you commence it, stuff starts going wrong. And a commander's job largely is to control the problems in order to keep the main goal in sight. Many commanders of that era and since simply can't do that. And especially if they're confronted by a surprise. I like to say there are two kinds of generals. There are those who get surprised, and there are those who lie. Everybody gets surprised. Grant was surprised at Belmont. He's surprised again at Fort Donelson. He's certainly badly surprised at Shiloh. Lee is surprised at Chancellorsville. Lee's tremendously surprised by Grant in 1864 when Grant moves his entire army out of Lee's front and across the James River. Lee doesn't know where they are. The mark of a great general is how he reacts to those surprises, and they both react identically. There's no panic. Unlike virtually all the other army commanders of that war, they don't pull back toward their capital to regroup and try to start the campaign over again. Grant looks at every situation like that and says, this isn't good. How do I turn this around to my advantage? Lee, the underdog, will either do the same or say to himself, what do I do now to stop this and negate the brief advantage the enemy has over me? That's a rare quality. There's no panic. There's no frustration. There's no defeatism in either of their characters. And more to the point, along with the way they respond to the unexpected, another paramount gift each had, and I think it simply came from the inner man, is that ultimately they were willing. They had the characters that could take enormous risks, risk everything perhaps, full in the knowledge that if it failed, the responsibility would be theirs, if full in the knowledge that thousands of men were likely to lose their lives, that they could take that decision and live with it and not let it eat them up. They remind me of Harry Truman when he had to make the decision about the bomb, or Truman the night before he was the election in 1948, when he figured, I've done all I could.